Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, we talk about the ideas and the strategies, the structures, the ways to make this happen. I tell you about my epic mistakes that I've made along the way because I am still on this same journey as everybody else. But the goal is to help boost creativity in the classroom. And one of the ways to do it is through something called vintage innovation. So this series right now that we're in is on this idea of vintage innovation. And it's an idea that I'm going to be exploring in a book with the same title. It's going to come out in early January. And I want to start out by telling you a story about baseball, or rather ballparks. And if you don't love baseball and you don't love stadiums, please bear with me because this has nothing to do with teaching, but it has everything to do with teaching at the same time. So let's take a dive into it. The Astrodome was a modern miracle, a space age wonder with a glass dome, high tech air conditioning, and the world's biggest scoreboard. When it opened in 1965, reporters dubbed it the eighth wonder of the world. This was the future. No more bad weather or quirky dimensions or anything else that made baseball messy and unpredictable. With the largest Jumbotron, the trendiest color choice, that amazing orange, burnt orange and yellow, if you remember the old school Astros, and a modern symmetrical design, this was the embodiment of the space age. And of course, this was in the space city. Houston. They're still called the Astros. This was the anti-Fenway Park, which was the oldest existing stadium at the time and still is the oldest ballpark. This was the stadium of the future. And yet, within minutes of the first pitch, people noticed a fatal flaw. A simple pop fly nearly blinded the player, so they had to paint the ceiling tiles black. This in turn killed the grass because it turns out you need photosynthesis to keep things growing. And that led to the patented AstroTurf, a clean, smooth, flat-looking artificial turf that added to this futuristic feel of the stadium. If you grew up in the 80s, you probably remember that mint green carpet that used to pass as grass in all the different stadiums. That was the AstroTurf. But unfortunately, the AstroTurf in turn led to career-ending injuries for many different players. It was just not the same as actual grass. Now, the Astrodome wasn't designed for the players. It was designed for the future. It was future-focused, not player-focused or fan-focused. And within two decades, this eighth wonder of the world had become a concrete relic of the false promise of futurism. In constructing the stadium for the future, the design team had mistakenly believed that innovation was future-driven rather than purpose-driven. And in the process, they created something flashy and novel and new and amazing, but not timeless or sustainable or innovative. By the mid-1980s, nearly every Major League Baseball team had the same kind of massive, modern, donut-shaped stadium. But the architects in Baltimore had a different idea. Oriole Park in Camden Yards would be quirky and creative, connected to the community, and built with the players and fans in mind. When the team's owner pushed for a multi-purpose stadium, the team president, Larry Lucchino, pushed back. Let's look at the most successful baseball franchises out there. The Yankees have Yankee Stadium. The Cubs have Wrigley Field. The Red Sox in Fenway Park. And what do they all have in common? They all played in baseball-only facility. A facility that was designed for baseball and did not compromise architecturally for other sports. So the architecture team chose to look backward, to look forward. Their vision was an old-fashioned traditional baseball park with modern amenities. They borrowed ideas from the ghosts of demolished stadiums of the past. Places like Ebbets Field and Shy Park and the Polo Grounds and other ballparks that had been demolished and replaced with these concrete, uniform, donut-shaped stadiums. Instead of building with a clean slate at the edge of the suburbs, like all these other ballparks had been, they designed a ballpark for the heart of the city. Now, there are some flaws in that, right? There's some people who got really frustrated with the gentrification, and there are certainly groups that were left out in this process. It wasn't perfect, and I don't want to glorify that. But from an architectural standpoint, it really was different, and it really was amazing. Instead of bulldozing the enormous old B&O warehouse, they incorporated it into the design. In other words, the very thing that was the flaw became part of the solution. Similarly, the odd-shaped plot of land led to quirky field dimensions and really different sight lines. If you go to Camden Yards, you'll see the field in ways that you simply can't see in a donut-shaped stadium. In other words, they embraced limitations and treated barriers as design features. In the end, they had a cozy ballpark with a view of the city skyline and an atmosphere that felt timeless. Decades later, Camden Yards has already lasted longer, far longer, than the Astrodome did. It's still relevant. Now, its attendance is down because the Orioles, you know, suck, and they're kind of tanking to try to rebuild a team. But the reality is, it's still one of the most beautiful places to watch a game. Camden Yards was a case of vintage innovation, incorporating old ideas and approaches into a new design in a way that felt timeless rather than futuristic. And I mention this because I had my Astrodome moment in the classroom. It had started out with vintage innovation. I had embraced this idea of limitations. I had embraced the idea of renovating old things and making them new. And so what I did is I took old computers that we were going to be getting rid of anyway, and I ran these suckers on Linux. And it worked. I mean, these were old computers, suddenly felt like they were brand new. And then I spent the entire summer configuring my paperless classroom. And I would call it that. I would say, this is paperless social studies. This is paperless history. This is paperless teaching. I owned that concept of paperless. I loved it. I mean, this was going to be the future. Instead of physical mind maps, we would use concept mapping software. Instead of having Socratic seminars, we would use back channels and online chats. And I was convinced that the future was digital and my class was cutting edge. No, not even cutting edge, bleeding edge. I would take us into the future. But then within the first quarter, things began to fall apart. The novelty wore out. The internet was spotty. Things took way too long to work. And more importantly, I failed as a teacher to see the positive elements of old school tools. And so I want to think about the reasons we would want old school tools. The first is that vintage tools encourage divergent thinking and creativity. Sometimes you need older tools to work within constraints. I mentioned this because, when I had an amazing technology in a studio. We had Final Cut Pro, we had a green screen, we had nice cameras in my classroom. And yet, the most creative videos we did were these sketchnote videos that students created on the whiteboards. I mean, it was a whiteboard, a marker, and a smartphone. That constraint led to these really cool sketchnote videos. The second concept is that when students are making things by hand, they are part of the entire process. Sometimes technology does too much of the mental heavy lifting for the students. At times, a 3D printer can work like Guitar Hero. You know, you think you're making the music, but it's doing all the work for you. And in some cases, I've seen 3D printers that are basically just no different than regular printers, and there's not much creative thinking going into what's being created. And so by contrast, sometimes duct tape and cardboard and Legos and things like that can actually lead to deeper creative thinking because you have to own the entire process with your own two hands. And that leads to the third point, that sometimes low-tech tools are more developmentally appropriate. Younger students in particular need to make things with their bare hands. It won't be as polished, but they learn in a way that fits human development. There's a very real danger in asking students to use abstract programs when they're still in a concrete phase developmentally. In many cases, analog tools are more efficient and they're cheaper. And let's be real, if you spend a lot of money on brand new computers or you spend a lot of money on a 3D printer and a CAD machine, you're going to feel the pressure of using it all the time. You're going to feel like you have to get your money's worth. And I've experienced that myself. And so the idea is, if it's more expensive, then slowly the technology drives the learning, not the learning driving the technology. And finally, there are times where analog means that the learning sticks. We know, for example, that students retain information at a high, much higher level if they take notes by hand, right? And so this is the idea that, you know, sometimes we need analog tools to just make the learning stickier. So what are some ideas in terms of vintage ideas that we could embrace in the modern classroom? Well, here are a few different ideas. Number one, sketchnoting. I love having students doodle out ideas. I did this with my eighth graders. I do this now with my university students. I love having people doodle things, draw them out, sketch them out. There's a great book called Making Thinking Visible. I highly recommend that. It's the same kind of concept. But sometimes they're doodling out ideas in a mind map. Sometimes it's a diagram or an annotated picture. Sometimes it's using sticky notes during brainstorming. But the idea is sketchnoting ideas in a visual way. Number two is commonplace books. Like sketchnoting, commonplace books are use simplicity to drive complexity. Students can sketch out ideas and diagrams and observations. They can tape in clippings and pictures they find that can unfold in bizarre different ways. And over time, students can create an internal organizational structure that both reflects and facilitates their thinking. Now, if you've never heard of commonplace books, they were around for centuries. Commonplace books are this very vintage idea of community curation. For centuries, people kept these commonplace books to curate things that they were into. And they would pass these books back and forth, leaving comments in the margin, writing things from scratch, developing their own internal organizational structure. They would tape in things like verses from scripture. They would tape in, things from almanacs. They would have recipes. They would find bits and pieces of article, pictures of art that they liked. I mean, it was just a common collective place to find things and share them back and forth. And I think commonplace books can be both digital and physical in the classroom. And it's a very vintage idea that you could get into. Number three, prototyping with duct tape and cardboard. I love the fact that so many schools have embraced things like the cardboard challenge. It's the opposite of setting up a model on a computer and printing it to a 3D printer. But this physical manipulation allows students to engineer things in a way that focuses on problem solving. And these limitations of physical prototyping often push divergent thinking. And it's similar than to the limitations that you saw in Camden Yards, right? Being forced to work with the limited resources pushes you to do better. Number four, the natural world. I love the idea of gardens, and it allows for deeper thinking. It allows for more creativity. There's a lot of research on how walking out into nature can lead to better divergent thinking, how it allows synapses to connect in a way that's different than any other kind of activity. I mean, there's fascinating research on it, but it can also inspire better creative work. There's this whole field in engineering called biomimicry, and I've written a blog post, done a podcast on this concept. I am a huge fan of incorporating nature. Number five, play. The idea is simple. Play matters. We need movement. We need play. We need simulations. We need game-based learning, and not necessarily on the computer. I'm talking about doing all of this in an old school way. Number six, Socratic seminars. There's a lot of cool different ways to lead Socratic seminars, but you can do a vintage innovation variation on this, but taking the Socratic seminar concept and making it into a podcast. We used to have Philosophical Friday podcasts, and it started as a whole class Socratic seminar, but then I realized not everybody was getting a chance to really speak up, and then I broke them into smaller groups of about six or seven, and they did these same Socratic seminars as a podcast, and it was really powerful. Number seven is hands-on games and simulations. I kind of got into this a bit with play, but this is the idea that students just need these hands-on simulations to learn concepts. It's a great way of doing concept attainment lessons. Number eight is experiments. Just having students do experiments makes a huge difference. And again, hands-on experiments, not with a video. And in fact, there's some fascinating research. Jared Cruz shared this with me about having students learn how to sketch their experiments. And it's not that their sketches are better than if they take a picture. In fact, they're oftentimes not. But the act of sketching during an experiment leads to deeper observation than if you had simply taken a picture. So the idea is that as they learn how to sketch what's happening in an experiment, they actually learn how to observe better. And then finally, manipulatives. I think math manipulatives belong not just in the primary grades, but in the upper grades, and yes, in the secondary level. I know somebody who teaches calculus and regularly uses manipulatives in calculus because there are things that you simply have to learn with your hands. So my final idea is this. Maybe it's time we abandon the idea that certain educational practices are outdated or certain tools are obsolete and realize that the best learning is timeless and that the best ideas are often buried under that industrial carpet of the schools. Some of the most innovative ideas are not based on boldly looking forward, but on quietly looking back to turn our collective gaze away from the future and to think about what we might have lost. Again, the exciting part, the vintage innovation part, is when we do that and then we turn to our current context and we look at our current tools and we mash those up together and we create something that's never been done before. Thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher? That would mean the world to me. Again, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.